So Sarah and I have realized over almost 11 years of marriage that we have different styles of parenting at times. You know how this works, right? So Sarah, when our kids are being a little disruptive, she comforts and woos them. She taught Emma this past week or so that when she gets frustrated, the first thing she needs to do is to come get a hug. My thinking was not towards get a hug. My thinking was just listen to me because I'll tell you what you're supposed to do. It never seems to work. But anyway, so I try to reason with my children. Sarah's like, woo them, Jason. Comfort and woo. I think they're human beings, all right? So we should be able to have a nice, reasonable conversation, and then they'll obviously come to the clarity of my logic. This is what should happen. Of course, rarely does that ever happen, and all I get is really Sarah rolling her eyes at me and then saying, go away, I'll take care of the mess. That's basically what happens. So I remember my mom was planning on coming, I think it was one spring, before Marty is around, and Emma was really, really excited about it. My mom was going to come to town. She wouldn't stop asking. Emma wouldn't stop asking when Grandma was going to come. And so we would just hear this all the time, and I remember it was the backseat of a car, and I would just hear, is it today, Daddy? Is Grandma coming today? And I swear for a week, this was just this constant. No, Emma, she's not coming today. She'll be here next week. Or, look, it's just two more days. You can handle two more days, right? It'd be something like that all the time. And so finally, she's almost here. We're almost there. And Emma's in that back seat of the car. And she's grown completely tired of waiting, all right? And she wants Grandma to be here, right then, right now. And I say, look, Grandma's flight doesn't leave until tomorrow, all right? It is physically impossible for her to get here today, all right? You're just going to have to wait. To which Emma replies with the immense logic of a four-year-old, whatever it is. She goes, Daddy, tomorrow is today. Tomorrow is today. I'm just like, I guess you can just will it to be or something like this. Well, tomorrow, folks, is not today. Except that when it comes to the season of Lent, I think we probably have this sort of like thing in the back of our head that wishes tomorrow might be today. That wishes we could sort of skip over these 40 days of Lent and get straight to the pancake breakfast on Easter morning, right? Straight to resurrection. We can skip over the ashes to ashes and dust to dust talk because it wants to... It makes us squirm a little bit. But the thing is, well, we can't. It's just not possible, right? If you haven't seen it already, I really encourage you to, in this month's Glad Tidings, to take a look at the On Liturgy section, all right? On the On Liturgy section, because the article there is... It tells us about why we follow what's called the liturgical calendar, why we do this thing called Epiphany, and then Lent, and then Easter, and then Pentecost, and later on in the year, why we start again at Advent, and then do Christmas, right? It tells us why we do these sorts of things. Well, the short and sweet of it, and I don't mean to spoil it, there's a lot more than this there, and so the short and sweet of it, though, is that the liturgical calendar helps us basically walk with Jesus. Walk with Jesus. We follow the life of Jesus throughout the year. We walk beside him all the way from the anticipation of his birth at Advent to the birth at Christmas to the Epiphany, the revelation of him as the Son of God at Epiphany, to Lent, to Easter, then to the coming of the Spirit at Pentecost. We follow the life of God in the world, all right? But that means we can't just skip over the hard stuff. Right, Jesus spent 40 days in the desert, and we spend 40 days in Lent. That's why we have it. Which means that today we end Epiphany, next week we begin Lent. Lent and Epiphany go hand in hand. It's intentional that way. They're inseparable. For the past couple months, we've been talking about ways in which the person and character of God have been revealed in Jesus Christ, all right? This has as much to do with Lent as it has to do with Epiphany, when those manifestations, those revelations of God happen. Lent is the time when we begin to see what all these epiphanies we've been talking about, what they really mean, what they really mean. If Jesus really is the Son of God, we say, what does that mean for us? Okay? How should we understand the nature of God in light of all these revelations of who God is? And then, just importantly, we need to ask, how should we understand these for ourselves? How should we understand these for ourselves? So that's Lent. But today is Transfiguration, Transfiguration Sunday. We might call it Epiphany's last hurrah of sorts. It's the crux that really binds the seasons of Epiphany and Lent together. You see, Transfiguration Sunday gets its name from this story in the Gospels, one I'm about to read to you, where Jesus' face and his clothes, they start shining with the glory of God. It's a story that tries to show how Jesus' identity as the Son of God can fit with the fact that he's also bound to suffer and die. But importantly, so it's a story that's also chock full of what we call allusions. Allusions, these parallels with Old Testament stories and people and other parts of the Bible, which makes this passage, this story, a bit more complicated and complex to figure out. So I'm going to read it to you a little slowly. And I want you to see if you can catch any of those parallels, all right? Any of those allusions to what I read earlier in Exodus 34 and in 2 Corinthians 3 and 4. If you have to get out those Bibles in your pew, go ahead and do it. All right, so when we look at these parallels, they'll be really important for helping us understand why in the world we celebrate Transfiguration. So here it is, Luke 9, Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 43. Just a little background. You see, this passage comes right after our favorite disciple, Peter, has just confessed that Jesus is the real Messiah, the one we call the Christ. Peter effectively says right before the Transfiguration story that Jesus is the guy that he believes is going to deliver God's people, like Moses delivered God's people. And then Jesus responds with these very important words. He says, "Well then, you should take up your cross and follow me." And then we get the Transfiguration story. Here's how it goes. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James, and he went up on the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became dazzling white. That's the Transfiguration part, by the way. And then suddenly, they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking with Jesus. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Just as these men were leaving, Peter said to Jesus, not really knowing what to say, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." But while he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from within the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my Son, my chosen, listen to him." When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent. And in those days, no one told of any of the things they had seen. Did you catch the parallels? Did you see the allusions? In Exodus 34, if you remember from our reading earlier, Moses also comes down from the mountain with his face all shiny. But there's a lot more going on here than Moses appearing in both stories. I'll read you the Exodus story again and see if it doesn't give us some help. Then Moses came down from Mount Sinai. As he came down from the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant in his hand, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, the skin of his face was shining. They were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses spoke with them. And afterward, all the Israelites came near, and he gave them in commandment all the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. There's a lot to unpack here. But if you want to understand what's going on in Jesus' transfiguration story, we've got to know what's going on in this one about Moses. Luke is a huge fan of alluding to these Old Testament passages, and he does it all over the place. Yet, and here's the very important thing, when these New Testament guys allude to the Old Testament, they don't do it just for fun. They do it to show a difference. They draw the similarities to show something importantly different between the two. So Luke wants to say something else, which means that the parallels are there as much to highlight differences that Luke wants to play up. We get a really good example of this, actually, in the Apostle Paul, not in our passage for today, but elsewhere. He talks about Jesus is the new Adam, he says. He's drawing this parallel with the Adam of Genesis 2 and 3. Y'all know this Adam, the first human, married to Eve, you know, takes a bite of the apple, sins, does this sort of stuff. All right, so Jesus, Paul says, is like this new Adam, all right? Jesus is like Adam because he's the first and he brings life. But the allusion here for Paul is actually meant to highlight some key differences between Jesus and Adam. Paul says that whereas Adam brings sin into the world, Jesus brings, can you guess it? Salvation, deliverance, life. All right? Both Adam and Jesus start all of humanity on a certain course, but the direction of each of those courses is remarkably different. So the parallels between Jesus and Adam are there, but they have the effect of highlighting something very significantly different. And it's those differences that our New Testament writers are trying to teach us about. This is really just how allusions work in the New Testament. This is what they're meant to do. They highlight very important distinctions. The allusions Luke uses in the story of Jesus' transfiguration do the same thing. And some of the similarities, I think, are pretty easy to see. I counted 5 of them, and so we should take a test and see how many you got. Both stories talk about coming down from a mountain after there's been an epiphany or some sort of manifestation of God's glory, all right? So that's the first one. Both stories talk about coming down from a mountain after an epiphany of God's glory. Both talk about how the divine glory leaves this kind of shiny residue on somebody's face, right? Both talk about this divine glory shining on people's faces. In both of the stories, there's the third one, people are afraid of the glory of God. They're afraid of it. All right? In the Exodus passage, the Israelites are so afraid, they're like, Moses, put a veil on your face. Veil that thing. Get rid of that. All right? Whereas in Luke, Peter, James, and John are just said to be afraid, and Peter just goes, let's hide that in a tent or something like this. All right? Number 4, God is described as giving commandments in both passages. In the Exodus, it's literally, you can see them up here again, literally those 2 big stone tablets, right? The 10 commandments, all right? And then Moses has them and he delivers them to the people. In Luke, God speaks and commands and says, this is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. Listen to him. The new law is here, he says. It's another allusion, another parallel. There's a 5th one, too, that wasn't in the Exodus text that we read, but if you read before it, you see it. It's that cloud. God comes to Moses on the mountain in a cloud, and he sits among the people in a cloud, and then the cloud shows up in the Luke passage, too. God comes within the cloud. All right? That's a lot of similarities. But Luke is trying to say something different. He wants to say that despite the similarities, Jesus is superior to Moses. Jesus is actually greater than Moses. How do we know this? Where does Moses' glory come from? It reflects God's, right? God's glory. Where does Jesus' glory come from in the story? It's his own. It's like dripping from his own pores, which is a gross image, but let it sear into your brain. Jesus' glory dripping from his own pores. All right? Just look at the text. Even though Jesus and Moses both shine with God's glory, Jesus' glory is his own. Moses only reflects God's glory, but Jesus emanates it. His glory is inherent, Luke wants to tell us, inherent to his being the Son of God, inherent to him being divine, all right? And that's the point. Jesus is really and truly God, Luke is wanting to say, even if his way of being God is not what we expect. Remember, the disciples, Peter has just said, you are the Messiah. You're the Messiah, the one who's going to deliver us. And Jesus goes, absolutely right. Good job, Peter. Now take up your cross, because all of this is about suffering and dying. And Peter doesn't really get it. So we have the transfiguration, where God says, listen, he knows what he's talking about. This is my son, suffering and dying. So Jesus' glory is not just your everyday divinity, right? This isn't your everyday glory. That's what the transfiguration is all about. And that's why it's such an important link between Epiphany and Lent. It tells us just what kind of God Jesus is. And thanks to that, what kind of disciples we're supposed to be too. So it may sound strange, because Lent we usually think of as this time of repentance, right? This time of separation between us and God. That we recognize our difference, our holy otherness than God. We think of it as a time when we give things up to help us remember that God is God and we are not. That's why we put our ashes on our foreheads, right? On Ash Wednesday, to show that we are lowly people. Because we want to remember that we are nothing but dust, and to dust we will return. To some extent, all of that is true. Right? God is the holy other. We're totally different. We're less than him. But Transfiguration Sunday shows us that there's this really deep and profound glory in being dust. In being dust. And it's not just our glory. It's the full-on glory of God. It's the glory of God. The story of the Transfiguration has often been preached as a metaphor for our spiritual lives. It's said that there will be moments in our lives when we're going to have these mountaintop experiences. We're going to experience the glory of God washing all over us, and we'll just be up there basking in a sunny brightness. But then it's told that we have to come down from that mountain, that these experiences are few and far between. Luke tells us in the very next paragraph from the Transfiguration story, he tells us that Jesus comes down from the mountain the next day, and when he does, he runs into this really big crowd, and he runs into this demon-possessed boy whom nobody seems to be able to heal. And these sermons on the Transfiguration, they tend to go that we experience these high heights of epiphany when we realize we're always followed by the low lows of Lent, right? Highs and lows, and we're like Jesus on the mountain, and then we're like Jesus among the people doing the dirty work of God. That stuff will preach, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the Transfiguration story. Nothing. Luke isn't trying to give us a picture of our own spiritual experiences. He's trying to pound home the fact that the one who is about to suffer and die is God's son. And that's the way it should be. Remember, all this talk about transfiguration began once again with Peter calling Jesus the Messiah and Jesus responding by telling him that the Messiah must suffer many things, including being rejected by God's own people, and that the Messiah is inevitably going to be killed. This is not the type of glory we associate with divinity, with sunny brightness. It's the glory of the cross. It's the glory of the blood that flows down from that cross. It's the glory of the dirt that you wash off your neighbor's feet. It's the glory of the days that you spend taking care of sick kids, or your spouse, or your parents, or even the stranger you meet coming out of the grocery store. It's the glory of the dedication, determination you show when you stand alongside others in pain and suffering, even when it hurts. And it's the glory of the ashes that on Wednesday we're going to put on our foreheads. Humility, sacrifice, repentance, giving up of ourselves for others, these are the things that shine with the glory of God. Not wealth, not high golden kingship, not success, not even health. When Moses came down from the mountain with a face full of glory, nobody wanted to get close to it or even look at it. Everybody realized that seeing the real glory of God would cost them something. It would require them to change. It might even cause them to die, but maybe not in the way that they probably supposed. Maybe seeing the glory of God as humility, as sacrifice, as repentance would end up giving them new life. New life, but maybe a life that's a little bit different from anything they had ever known or heard about before. That new life is what Lent is all about. It's the hope and the promise of Lent. New life. Resurrection life. But it all begins by putting ashes on our face. So are you ready for Wednesday?